ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife history.
Well, the Second World War concluded more than 8 decades ago, but it was such a turbulent time in our world's history that there are still tales of wartime exploits being told, and many of them for the first time. My guest tonight in the Nightlife studios is Patricia Skeehan. Now, Patricia is an expert in recounting Australian wartime tales, and she's already published a number of works recounting the real-life exploits of Australian Anzacs in the First World War. She's also given a lot of talks on the exploits of Australia's servicemen and servicewomen. Her latest book is called Whispering Death, and it recounts the wartime feats of the Australian Air Force's 93 Squadron and the Australian-built bow fighter aeroplanes that they used as their weapons of war. Patricia, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you with us as well. The bow, the bow fighters were an English, they were a British-built aircraft, weren't they? Built under, but a number of them, I think there were about more than 300, weren't they? They were built here in Australia, weren't they?
Exactly the same number of days, 365, so that was easy to remember.
Oh, okay.
There were a few more that were in production at the end of the war, but they were rejected because they weren't complete.
Right. Why were they known as the Green Ghosts?
That was partly to do with the camouflage, but also with the emblem that they chose for their squadron plaque, because as Lerin mentioned, the 93rd was formed fairly towards the end of the war, and all of the good phrases and, you know, jokes and things had been taken. So they had this phrase called spookiness, sneakiness sort of thing, they made it into a Latin phrase and had this ghost sitting on top of a rocket. So it was just a joke in a way.
You know, I see.
For them to do.
Yeah. I mean, because there was another name around for the bow fighters, which when some say were known as Whispering Death, but this seems a bit apocryphal too, doesn't it?
Well, that name came about because of the fact that this bow fighter made here was the only one that had just one engine. All the other aircraft had engines that sort of balanced each other. You know, one went clockwise, the other anti-clockwise, and that always made a great noise and a lot of vibration. Whereas when they brought the kits out from England and assembled them here, there was just the one kit for one engine, and so they put two of those onto the plane, but they both rotated right, and there was no vibration and no noise until they got overhead. So that's why it was called the Whispering Death.
Okay. Yeah, there were – that's right. I think a lot of people will probably forget that Australia did make warplanes. I mean, some of them weren't that good. But the Australian-built bow fighters, they were built under licence here, as you say. They were twin-engined heavy fighters, weren't
yes.
they? Yeah, tell us
yes.
about them.
Well, the whole point was that they could get overhead, they could bomb, and they, because of the configuration under the wings, they could have a multiple of choices depending on what their mission was. They could either have rockets or they could have cannons or they could have cameras if they were just sort of on reconnaissance.
Mm.
Yeah, so they're quite versatile.
Mm. Were they any good, Patricia?
Oh, yes, of course they were.
well, not of course they were, because as we know, a number of Allied aircraft were not much chop. And, gee, for early on in the Second World War, of course, the poor old Wirraways were no match at all for the Japanese Zeros, were they?
No, that was true. But as I said, they were well made here in Australia. It was really virtually the start of our aircraft production in Australia.
Hmm. They were made, where are they made? At Fisherman's Bend, weren't they?
Fisherman's Bend was one of the places. They had a couple of places where they retooled some of the factories to help with it.
Hmm. You got on to telling the stories of the men in the 93 Squadron because you knew the sister of one of the pilots, is that right?
Yes, I've known her for many years, but I never connected her maiden name and her married name. I only ever knew her as Mrs. Wright.
Hmm.
And apparently her brother had been very frustrated with another writer who had the collection of these 20 boxes of all sorts of everything, memorabilia and all the official and unofficial documentation. And nothing had been done for years. So she said to him, why don't you go around and see Trish and see if she'll do it? And when he arrived and told me that story, I had all sorts of red flag warnings, thinking, you know, well, if someone else hasn't done anything in years, you know, what's it going to be like? But I sat down with him and showed him one of the photograph albums and said, you know, tell me a bit about this. And honestly, he started crying. There was tears down his face.
Mm.
And he opened with these wonderful words that said, you know, there are moments in life that still haunt me. There are sights and sounds that pass through my eyes and ears into my mind, but they reside in my soul. And I thought, good heavens, you know, I grabbed my tape recorder and I thought, this is what I need, the emotion in the story. And so as we went around over the following months and interviewed his, we can't call them observers, they're navigators. The guys were initially hesitant, some of them, about me, you know, private or snooking into their lives. And I would record what they said and then type it up for them and give it back to them so they could correct any mistakes or, you know, any things that I had misunderstood, and then I would get them to sign off on it before we actually made it part of the official manuscript.
Sure. So tell me about the squadron itself. I mean, the Beaufighters, as I said, the ones were made in Australia, but this was towards the end of the war, wasn't it? Were they flying them here, the British-built ones, beforehand?
Not that I'm aware of, but as I said, there are a number of squadrons already who mainly had gone overseas by that time. And so with this 93rd Squadron being formed, it was out at Narromine. And then they flew up to Kingaroy to do some final training and went on to Coomalee up past Darwin and then off into Brunei and Borneo and those places.
So what role did they play? Well, this would have been towards the end of the war. What role did they play in the war against Japan?
Well, they were doing a lot of reconnaissance work. And flying missions. And one of the things was actually watching as to how the Japanese were getting their supplies through, because at times they couldn't work out how they were doing it. So there's this great story where two of the Beaufighters were flying along the coast one morning and they happened to spot an island complete with palm trees and coconuts sailing along, leaving a bow wave. And so they were very surprised at that. And as I said, because of the fact that the planes were silent, it was actually a Japanese barge where they had covered it with tarps, put lots of sand on it, stuck a few trees on it and coconuts, and were going along the coast. And because they didn't hear the Beaufighters, they hadn't stopped in time to just appear to be a little island. So the two Bowies came around and strafed them, and the next thing, the whole thing exploded. So they were good at doing things like that.
Okay. Well, so it's presumably some sort of fuel transport, was it?
Yes. They were getting their the ammunition along the coast that way.
Yeah.
But one of the main tasks that Lerin had to do was to fly over Sandakan to find all of the prisoners that were missing, and he couldn't find anything, obviously, because they were all gone, apart from the six that were hiding in the jungle. And he was actually threatened with court-martial for being derelict in his duty. And he said the next day they sent another plane out that was even faster, one of their lighter fighter planes, and he said they were whizzing across the jungle at 400 miles an hour and they couldn't see anything either. So, and then a few days later, once the war actually ended, he was the pilot who was tasked with dropping these stones that had all the paperwork around them on how the Japanese were to surrender. And he had to fly over the actual Japanese camp at Sandakan and drop those stones and then come back. And as he said, they were firing on him at the time. But he said it was mainly with rifles. So, you know, rifles don't do much against a plane.
No, and they wouldn't have been aware at all, would they, in the Beaufighters, of the horror of that happened.
What was going on.
That happened down there in Sandakan. Yeah, it must... most appalling sequence of events, as we know. So they also distributed leaflets, as you say, to the Japanese population, informing them of the surrender. This was in Japan after the war, wasn't it? After the war?
No, this was in around the island areas.
Oh, okay.
Lerin didn't actually go to Japan. He was tasked then, once the war was over, with escorting the Spitfires home.
All right.
And they landed in November in Brisbane, and he said they gave lots of stories to the press there, had lots of photos taken and were told the next day your arrival is going to be spread all over the newspapers around Australia. But the next day the newspaper headline said Hitler is dead, and that had knocked their story off the front page, and Lerin was very upset about that. But it was amazing for me to see that, because Hitler died in April 1945,
yes,
and this was in December. So why wait 7 months to tell people? And then, as I said, instead of having the fact that our boys were coming home, have it all about Hitler.
It's That's weird. That's weird, actually, because of the story.
Well, he actually kept the front page of the newspaper, and I have it here today. And it's one of the things we're going to be showing is the memorabilia at the launch on Thursday. And as I said, it's got the story all about Hitler. And, of course, it's in a special sort of casing. And when you turn it around on page two, you've got so many more of the war stories as well.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Because, I mean, the news was known. Of the German surrender by this stage as well.
Yeah. Well, Aaron said that he was really peed off with Hitler, not because of what he'd done, because we didn't know so much about it then, but because of the fact that he'd knocked their arrival off the front page of the paper.
Yeah. Okay. So, so they had a whole roll around the islands and so on. What happened to the planes after the war? Because there's hardly any of them left, are there?
No, it's really tragic. They actually scrapped most of them down in Wagga. They sold them off to Sims Metal for £10 each for scrap metal.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah. But there were a couple of other squadrons as well that were connected. And during my research, I actually came across several of my own colleagues who gave me the memoirs of their one of her father. Mm-hmm. He was in the 30 Squadron, and he told this fantastic story of being at the Battle of the Bismarck Sea and how it was all over in 28 minutes with all of these planes spiralling around and all that they were doing. And then one of my other colleagues that I work with at one of the schools, he said my mum and dad were in the RAAF as well. Mm-hmm. And I got their stories, and his mother was actually in part of Bletchley Park, you know, Barton Hall, all the security. Mm. And he said for years there was just this whole lot missing from the family history of mum's history because she wasn't allowed to say anything about it.
Yeah, we know what happened at Bletchley Park now, don't we? But that's right. But there's probably more work to be done in books in the women who worked as code breakers, isn't there, Patricia?
Well, most of them are dead now and they haven't told their stories, so that's the sad part about it.
Yeah.
But Ted has one amazing story, which is called the Airscrew Debacle, if you've got a minute to hear that one.
Yeah.
When the pilots left Sydney, Ted said they went to New Zealand, picked up some pilots there, went up to Canada, picked up some more there and got into London. And at the time that they arrived, there was a little airfield down in Khartoum, and the boss there was asking for 50 air screws, which is what they used to call propellers.
Propellers, yeah.
But as the story went through, someone left the S out of the middle of air screws, and it read by the time it got to London, send urgently 50 air crews. So these boys, Ted and some of the New Zealanders and the Canadians, were all sent down to Khartoum. And, of course, they arrive there and the boss finds them and says, "Where's my 50 propellers?" And they say, we thought it was air crew you wanted. And because he wouldn't take responsibility, because he said, "I didn't order you," the men had to stay there. And they got in touch with London, and London said, "Our official paperwork said we were to send air crew," so they wouldn't take responsibility. Now, these poor pilots are all sitting there and they can't do any flying because the air propellers didn't turn up to fix the planes. And so these guys were, honestly, for 9 months from the time they left London till the time they got back was 9 months. And as they said, there was this Butte war, overseas, but they couldn't do anything about it. And it was only when Lord Casey came down to Khartoum and they got a delegation to him and told him that they were stuck there and that there was no accommodation for them. They were sleeping on ground sheets on the hangar floor. And so Lord Casey got into touch with London and got the boys back, and then they had all these air crews, so they had to form the 466 Squadron Bow Fighters. And although they are known as the 466, it's actually an RAF because it was formed in England, but it was Australian pilots and New Zealand and Canadian pilots all mixed together.
In a way, I suppose, the fact that they were out of the war is lucky for them.
Well, in some ways it was. It kept some of them
That's
safe.
Right.
But,
exactly.
After that, they said, "From now on, you must order propellers, that device which propels the aircraft forward, rather than call them air screws, so that this debacle would never happen again."
Yes. Patricia, always great to talk with you. Always terrific stories as well. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.